This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. American authorities have seized a range of Iran state-linked news websites they accuse of spreading disinformation. The move Tuesday appears to be a far-reaching crackdown on Iranian media and heightened tensions between the two countries. The U.S. Justice Department said 33 of the seized websites were used by the Iranian Islamic Radio and Television Union, which was singled out by the U.S. government last October for what officials described as efforts to spread disinformation and sow discord among American voters ahead of the 2020 presidential election. The takedowns come as world powers scramble to resurrect Tehran's tattered 2015 nuclear deal. The UN's top envoy for Afghanistan is now urging the international community to do everything possible to push the Taliban and the government from the battlefield back to the negotiating table. Deborah Lyons warned that inertia and the lack of action might lead to more bloodshed and conflict. She told the UN Security Council Tuesday that she cannot overstate her concern at the current situation. Lyons said every major trend, politics, security, the peace process, the economy, humanitarian emergency, and tackling of COVID-19 is either negative or stagnant. She pointed to increasing Taliban violence over the last year alone. More than 40 countries are urging China to allow the UN Human Rights Chief immediate access to Xinjiang region to look into reports that more than a million people have been unlawfully detained there, some subjected to torture or forced labor. The joint statement on China was read out by Canadian Ambassador Leslie Norton on behalf of countries including Australia, Britain, France, Germany, Japan, and the United States to the UN Human Rights Council. Beijing denies all allegations. This is VOA News. Hospital system workers in the major U.S. city of Houston have been fired or resigned altogether after refusing to be vaccinated against COVID-19. AP correspondent Mike Rossia.
More than 150 employees at Houston Methodist Hospital System who refused to comply with the COVID-19 vaccine mandate have been fired or resigned. A spokesperson for the system says 153 employees resigned or were terminated on Tuesday after a two-week suspension period. The departures followed a ruling by a federal judge that threw out a lawsuit filed by 117 employees challenging the requirement. On June 12th, U.S. District Judge Lynn Hughes said if employees of the hospital system objected to the requirement, they could work elsewhere. The plaintiffs have filed an appeal. I'm Mike Gracia.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security is offering another chance to thousands of asylum seekers whose claims were dismissed or denied during the Trump administration. We get details from AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Applicants who were subjected to the previous administration's Remain in Mexico policy and were unable to appear for their court hearings are being allowed to register again with Homeland Security. One advocate group is estimating this will affect at least 10,000 migrants, although it's believed about 40,000 could be eligible. Many of them are believed to have left the Mexico border region, raising the possibility they'll make that dangerous trek to return. On his first day in office in January, President Biden halted the Remain in Mexico policy, allowing 26,000 asylum seekers with active cases back into the United States. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is signaling that she is poised to create a new committee to investigate the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, pushing closer to a partisan investigation of the attack after U.S. Senate Republicans blocked the creation of an independent probe. A person familiar with the matter said after a meeting with the Democrats that Pelosi had told her colleagues that she would create a select panel. Person spoke on condition of anonymity. As much as passengers are eager to return to the skies, they likely do not miss all the frustrations that come with airplane travel. And now the pandemic has made the experience even more unpleasant with rules around masks and differing opinions on whether to comply. That has led to unruly behavior and more fights on flights. Airlines have reported about 3,000 cases of disruptive passengers since January 1st. It has gotten so bad that the airlines, flight attendants, and pilots sent a letter to the U.S. Justice Department urging that more be done to deter egregious behavior. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Some Democratic Republic of Congo rebels surrendered their weapons.
Those who accept to surrender, they are accepted by the army peacefully, and they can give back their weapon. And that's what the new military governor of North Kivu said in Masisi.
Burundi says the European Union has lifted sanctions on the Central African country. We'll get reaction. What's behind the spate of armed robberies in Zimbabwe? Cameroon's first female deputy chiefs battle gender inequalities. And there's a need for Africa to produce its own vaccines for COVID and other illnesses.
The need was there anyway, but COVID-19 has actually emphasize the need for Africa to venture into vaccine manufacture and become a global player in vaccine manufacture.
And the plight of widows in Kenya on this International Day of Widows. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. More than 140 rebel fighters in the Democratic Republic of Congo surrendered themselves and their weapons to authorities. The move on Monday comes more than a month after the DRC government imposed a state of siege on Kivu and Ituri provinces in an effort to stem the surge in militant violence. Journalist Jaffa El Katanti was at the surrender ceremony in the city of Kichanga, and he spoke with viewers Kate Pound Dawson about what led to the surrender.
Fighters came from different militias in Masisi territory and Walikale. Some of them are from FDLR, some Mai Mai's group, and Nyantura groups.
So what led to their surrender?
It's because of the pressure of operations. As you know, since the state of siege in North Kivu and Ituri provinces, army are executing many operations against the rebel groups. And during the operation, they also call for all of them to surrender. Those who accept to surrender, they are accepted by the army peacefully, and they can give back their weapon. And that's what the new governor, the military governor of North Kivu, said in Masisi when talking to people. He said the time of negotiation has been expired. Now we are imposing peace to all Congolese people. So if a militiaman is a Congolese, he has to surrender. Otherwise, he will receive the pressure of the Congolese army power.
Now, in addition to the governor's comments, how else is the government responding? Are they offering to help surrendered fighters return home or anything like that?
First, the governor said it's good news to see Congolese who accept to leave weapon and to take the process of peace. And because of that, they will make a biggest process for surrenders. Some of them are very young, who are not even 18 years old. Those will be taken care by UNICEF and NGOs, because they are children. And those who are not children, it will be on their choice. Someone who will need to become a soldier, all of them will be sent to a training center of FRDC so that they will become member of the National Army.
That was journalist Jaffa El Katanti speaking with viewers Kate Pound Dawson from the city of Kichanga in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Burundi said this week that the European Union has suspended sanctions it imposed on the Central African country. The government said this happened after meeting with EU ambassadors to Burundi. The sanctions, which suspended financial cooperation between Burundi and the EU, were imposed in 2016 after then-President Pierre Nkurunziza decided to seek a third term, which led to protests. But some Burundians say the election of President Evariste Ndayishimiye has brought about a new chapter of openness. Louis March is the Central Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. He says the European Union should not have lifted sanctions because there's evidence of continuing human rights violations in Burundi.
This is a decision taken by the European Union that is contrary to the principles of the European Union. The European Union purports itself to be an institution and a conglomerate of states that puts human rights first. And the fact is that while there's been some piecemeal gestures on the part of the government of Burundi with regards to releasing some political prisoners, systematic change has not happened in Burundi. I think it's important to remember that Burundi, before 2015, was seen as a beacon for the region for freedom of expression, for freedom of association, and for freedom of people to vote the way they wanted to. It was a place where there were opposition politicians, where journalists could criticize government policy. That is not the case anymore in Burundi. This is a closed country, and it's becoming increasingly more so. And it's a country where there still continues to be absolutely no accountability. And the thousands of people who have been killed since the violence in 2015, many of them killed by state actors, including the youth militia tied to the ruling party. So this is, in some ways, this could be viewed as a cynical move by the European Union. They clearly want to turn the page and restart with Burundi, but this does not reflect the real situation in Burundi with regards to human rights abuses.
But Luis, I think the Burundian government or supporters of the Burundian government would say that since the elections and the election of President Evariste Ndayishimiye has moved forward to improve its image and relations with other countries. What do you say to that?
Well, there you go. That's exactly it. The country has moved forward to improve its image, but that image polishing has not been met with realities on the ground. The fact is that the judiciary is closed. The judiciary is controlled by the president. You have human rights defenders and journalists that are locked up and that are held for years in prison. And then when the government decides it wants to, quote unquote, improve its image, it releases them. It gives them a pardon. These are people who have never committed a crime. They never should have been locked up in the first place. And while it is a very good thing that they're out of prison, they've been released, that doesn't mean that we should accept these gestures from the government of releasing these people as steps moving forward. What it means is that the government is actually further entrenching human rights abuses by perpetuating a system that continues to punish people for criticizing. So the steps forward by the Burundian government have been piecemeal in gestures, and they are done explicitly to improve the image of the country, not to actually address the human rights abuses that are ongoing, in particular since 2015.
Some would say this is not encouraging if, let's say, your group and critics of the government keep insisting that these sanctions should not be lifted. Then what happens to if the government wants to bring about development for the people of Burundi and is willing to be open?
So, you know, the Human Rights Watch is, we work in over 90 countries, and our job is explicitly to document human rights abuses and expose them and push for change. And our job is not to congratulate the government of Burundi for massive steps backwards with regards to its human rights policy. The fact is, the government is absolutely entitled to opening its country up to development. The government absolutely should want to have financial ties with groups like the European Union. These ties and this development is not mutually exclusive with a broad respect for human rights.
Luis, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much. Take care.
That was Luis March, the Central Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. Zimbabwe is experiencing a spate of armed robberies as the country's economic meltdown continues. This despite projections of economic growth from institutions such as the World Bank. From Bulawayo, Ade Gondo has this report.
Last week, Police Commissioner General Godwin Matanga instructed provincial commanders to deploy special units to deal with increasing number of armed robberies occurring across the country. He has directed the police to escalate stop and search patrols and roadblocks. It's part of an effort to reduce the proliferation of illegally owned guns, which the police say are behind the recent spike in armed robberies nationwide. The Minister of Home Affairs says authorities are working to stop the crimes but face many challenges, including the smuggling of firearms by criminal syndicates through the country's porous borders, resource constraints, and licensed firearms that have not been secured in a safe place and are thus easy to steal. Bulawayo province is one of the hotspots for armed robberies with fatalities in the past few months. Socioeconomic analysts say, aside from the COVID-19-induced challenges, are robberies of hard cash from homes and businesses that have little faith in the banking institutions to keep their money safe. They also say cross-border criminals from neighboring South Africa are active in transit heists and have lately been targeting security companies around the region. Senior Assistant Commissioner Patton Bangwa for Bulawayo Province could not give statistics on the number of robberies and played down the incidence of smuggled firearms.
See, when we get reports, we are simply told here's something that looks like a firearm. It's not very said here and there. It might be a firearm, it might not be a firearm. So for one to say these are smuggled guns, it's neither here nor there. We can only give a conclusive sort of assessment if we have really a firearm that would have recovered.
The Minister of Home Affairs acknowledged in Parliament that the police are under-equipped. The Minister of Finance announced recently that government has purchased an additional 100 vehicles and motorcycles to assist the police. But observers say there's likely not enough vehicles for all of the police stations around the country, especially in remote towns. Some observers charge that members of the armed forces may be involved in the armed robberies. For instance, a recent report by the Southern Africa Resource Watch accuses soldiers and police officers of involvement in illegal gold smuggling activities. Critics say members of the security forces have been apprehended in armed robbery cases, and security-issued weapons such as AK-47 rifles have been used in armed robberies. Police Chief Mbangwa had this reaction to the allegations.
For one to really say it was an AK, for us it's a bit difficult because you need to come for us to comment conclusively to say indeed it was an AK.
Farai Maguwu of Zimbabwe's Center of Natural Resource Governance says that it is highly unlikely that ordinary people would have access to guns because of the country's tough gun laws. He says those who do include the security sector, the military, the Central Intelligence Organization, the police, private security companies, and a few business people.
When you look at the rise in the state of robberies, you also look at the state of the economy, especially what the private security guards are earning, what the police, the military are earning. They're earning peanuts, these people, whilst also entrusting them with the weapons. It sets the country on a very dangerous path for criminality and the like. They're setting them up or inciting them to commit armed robberies.
Magu and others say that government could likely solve the problem in part by providing higher pay to members of the security sector so as to discourage them from stealing. If authorities do not grant pay increases, critics say they fear the attacks in Zimbabwe may continue to soar. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 23rd. Countries such as South Africa and Rwanda are the most likely targets for hubs where vaccines might be produced in Africa, according to the World Health Organization. The WHO Africa Regional Advisor on Vaccine Regulation Quality and Safety, Deki Akamori, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the need for vaccines for both COVID-19 and other illnesses to be produced in Africa.
The huge thing that's going on is to try and support South Africa, a company in South Africa, to at least manufacture the Janssen & Janssen vaccine. And then, of course, extending to receiving parts of the product to get from the U.S., a U.S. facility, and to complete the process in South Africa and see if we can manufacture, you know, or make more of these COVID-19 vaccines. But you see, this is only to help address the immediate gap, but it's also not going to fulfill the needs of the continent. I mean, you know the population of Africa. There's no way one facility in South Africa, even if we have 2-3 facilities, can make sufficient vaccine. We still absolutely need countries to donate doses for use on the continent. Now, the major discussion now is ongoing to really, really come up with a good plan which covers every aspect of vaccine manufacture, to building around these R&D hubs.
And are there certain countries that are looking more likely than others at this point?
Yeah, there are countries that are looking more likely. I mean, obviously, from the WHO point of view, the regulatory capacity is important. So we certainly are looking at countries with regulatory systems that are sufficiently, you know, robust, that, or that are on the rise, that can provide oversight. also based on the political will, the willingness to take the bold step forward. So there are countries like Rwanda, there are countries like South Africa. Ghana has one of the strongest regulatory authorities on the continent. Obviously, that's something you have to look out for. Senegal has a history of vaccine manufacture, but the regulatory system may not be that strong.
Obviously, in this context, people would think of COVID-19 vaccines. But are we talking about vaccines that can address other illnesses?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to think beyond COVID-19 vaccines. COVID-19 vaccines have actually really, really identified the need. The need was there anyway, but COVID-19 has actually emphasized the need for Africa to venture into vaccine manufacture and become a global player in vaccine manufacture.
I'll go back to COVID-19. There has been a lot of vaccine hesitancy, at least where I live, in Senegal and parts of West Africa. Do you think that if the vaccine was manufactured locally, that would help decrease hesitancy toward the vaccine?
It could, in fact. That is, in fact, a very, very important point you make. Because when you make a product, you make it because you want to use it. It could be a means of also overcoming the vaccine hesitancy and convincing populations that this is a good thing. Vaccines save lives.
That was Deki Akamori, WHO Africa Regional Advisor on Vaccine Regulation Quality and Safety. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Brazzaville. In northern Cameroon, councils of traditional rulers were customarily all men, but in the last 2 years have opened to women. These pioneer female deputy chiefs are battling early marriage in a region where the majority of girls are married before age 18. Moki Edwin Kinzeka narrates this report by Anne Unzuanku in Mokolo, Cameroon.
2 years ago, Fadimatu Adamu's parents arranged her marriage as a 16-year-old to a man more than twice her age. Her husband often beat her, says Adamu, until she was rescued by the region's first female chiefs. She says she was suffering there and didn't even have enough to eat. It was Adja Kaigama, says Adamu, who gave money to her older sister Aisatu, who came to take her back home. Cameroon's Council of Traditional Rulers, or chiefs, are customarily men. But in the last 2 years, 11 women, like Adja Kaigama Saidu, have been appointed as deputy chiefs. While they are still under the direction of a higher-ranking male chief, Saidu says the new role means they can do more to help women. Their work with women is to explain to them how they can go through the deputy chiefs to express their needs at the level of the chiefdom, she says, and to denounce violence against women. Saidu says women have problems that they cannot express to men. It is through the women chiefs, she says, that they easily express their needs. The UN's Children's Fund says while more than a third of Cameroonian girls are married before the age of 18 and miss out on school, the rate jumps to 60% in the country's north. Student Aisatu Chanigi got pregnant when she was 15 years old. Her parents wanted to pull her out of school and marry her off, but the women chiefs convinced them otherwise. Chanigi says the women chiefs came to talk with her parents and convinced them that even if she has a child, if the parents do not abandon their daughter, she has the right, she has every chance in the world to succeed. It took 4 years of lobbying by the Association of Women and Girls of the Adamawa region, AFADA, to get the chiefdoms to agree to open to women. AFADA President Francois Baba says that since 2019, the female chiefs have helped hundreds of women and girls in cases of gender-based violence and to access health care and education.
Dans un village où nous avons désormais nos femmes notables,
She says in the villages where they now have women chiefs, the feedback they have received from schools is that the enrollment rate of young girls has increased by 40% for this school year. Her father says they will continue to push for more women chiefs to reduce Cameroon's gender inequalities. For Anne Zwanke in Mokolo, Cameroon, Moki, Edwin Kinzeka, for VOA News.
Today, June 23rd, is International Widows Day, set aside in 2011 by the United Nations to draw attention to the voices of widows. According to the United Nations, there are at least 258 million widows around the world, with nearly 1 in 10 living in extreme poverty. The UN says many widows across the world have struggled for basic needs, their human rights and dignity. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, 15% of Kenyan population are widows, with rural widows being disadvantaged and their rights violated the most by harmful cultural practices.
In the past few years, the Kenyan government has marked International Widows Day with efforts to raise awareness on the plight of widows. With more than 8 million widows in Kenya, most of them are denied inheritance rights, evicted from their homes, forced into unwanted marriages, and others are taken through traumatizing widowhood rituals. Diana Ogutu lost her husband in 2018 after being married for 14 years, and due to harsh custom practices, Diana has never gone back to her home.
I lost my husband after a short illness, and life after that has not been easy. The customs and the traditions have not been friendly to me. So from the villagers, I never received kind treatments. It has been harsh. Like, as we speak, my house is like a hall. And even as we speak, this is now my second year, I've never stepped back home because I'm just scared. First of all, I was threatened by somebody that they will inherit me by force.
Widows are always stigmatized for life, and in most cases, many of these abuses go unnoticed. Roselyn Orua has been a widow for 13 years, having lost her husband during the 2008 post-election violence in Kenya. She came up with a foundation that has brought together more than 8,000 widows.
Rona Foundation was started as an idea of me wanting a space to heal 13 years as a childless widow. I have experienced different stages of discrimination, disinheritance, and harmful traditional practices meted on women when they lose their husbands.
Roselyn says most widows in Kenya have been accused of killing their husbands by the in-laws, and this leads to most of them losing their property.
From name-calling to accusations of why did you kill him, from discrimination to even how you are living with your husband as you are married. You know, in my community, widows are known as the wife of the grave. So even this naming, how you are associating a living woman with the grave, is also another level of mental torture.
The Marriage Act in Kenya calls for registering all marriages and granting women a legal basis for land ownership claims, as succession laws bars her husband's relatives from assuming her inheritance. Rose, however, says the legal succession in Kenya is very tedious.
Looking for legal documentation from succession to going even to court on matters of disinheritance is so costly and full of bureaucracy. So a lot of widows just give up. And then all these forms are in English, and so you need also a level of education to be able to process, you know, seek for your rights under the law. And so widows just get disinherited, even by scrupulous lawyers. And so the system is so difficult for a widow.
With this year's theme for Widow's Day being Invisible Women, Invisible Problems, this day works to encourage action in achieving full rights for widows and develop policies to address problems faced by widows. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
And that's it for this Wednesday, June 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you to have a very good day.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, the reparations debate. Should descendants of slaves be compensated for the free labor their ancestors were forced to render during slavery? We talk with two analysts who spar over the renewed push for reparations in America and discuss some contemporary experiments taking place in states and cities across the country. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.